Yeah, so since we're still a smaller church, we're not the, and we most of us have come from medium to larger sized churches, so we're used to having probably the bigger budget. We just, compared to like what we used to be, our budget's quite small, honestly. But I would just, yeah, just put it in social context that we want to build relationships with other people. And I think I'm kind of speaking our language. People, I've thrown these ideas and bounced them off in private to people, but now I'm kind of like publicly coming out of the closet and stating my particular agenda. So altruism, or by definition is disinterested in the local church, I think needs to either be questioned or perhaps exercised. So we want to get rid of altruism. I was just thinking a lot about what Bob said this past or last week about everything so abstract in the world that we live in and kind of moving into a concrete fashion. And even, I noticed that a lot. Like everybody's so abstract. If you walk down State Street and talk to people, don't want to talk to you. This whole world that we live in is very abstract. So I think the water that we swim in popular culture is very, to give a gift to somebody else, it's altruistic. You don't expect any type of social bonding to return, but I think scripture argues that way, and we should do that in the local church, if that makes sense. So we should be interested in our monetary gifts. Yeah, everything is abstract. Just think, so it's interesting. I guess this is getting recorded, but at Radius, when I like tell people that I'm going to visit elderly people in the hospital or going to meet with them, at first they're like shocked that I would spend time with everything so abstract. Like you just spend time in your specific demographic with people. And I'm like, I go to a church. Like, we pull from a wide variety of demographics, which is great because it always reminds me that it's not my specific demographic that is the center of the world. So it doesn't abstract age or people that are elderly are not just this abstraction in a nursing home. I actually spend time with people there. So, yeah. Or it's easier to think, like Bob's saying, our taxes just get pulled out of our checks, which is very abstract, and then it goes to the social safety net, which is not a bad thing. I'm not anti-social safety net, but at the same time, it's very abstract than building a relationship with somebody, which is a lot more blood, sweat, and tears than that. So. But it's just interesting because we're a smaller church than, so I'm going to argue one, two, or three. Pick one, two, or three. You don't have to pick 10, for example, and get involved in those. So our social context looks different than perhaps in the past. Okay, so striving for excellence. If local churches evaluate critically the gifts or graces that God has given to them, what I want to ask, what do they exceed at doing for the Lord? So, negative example, and I'm just using Sarah and I and how we think about how we can love our neighbor as ourselves by giving gifts to them. I can't play piano. Sarah can't play piano. I was thinking about Shirley in the back of my head when I did this because that's her gift. The Lord has given her that gift. I couldn't do piano as a means to do outreach to love my neighbor and build a relationship with them because I can't play the piano. That'd be really silly for me to do that. But how often do church consulting groups not actually sit down and take the time and ask churches what they excel at or what their gifts could be to the broader context that they live in? They tend to give, it's been in my experience, more generic answers or like a program that they could fit where it's not a, you should ask as a local congregation, what do we excel at and what can we do well and give that gift to others, if that makes sense. So that'd be really silly for me to go out and want to try to learn the piano and then I just couldn't do it. So positive example, Sarah and I have the ability, I don't know why, but through the Lord's grace to connect with immigrants, which we've seen on display in the past and in our local context with our neighbors. So it would make sense to start an English club or ESL outreach. But again, that's the supernatural gift that the Lord has given to us. I have no idea why people from that background are attracted to me. It's weird. I don't think looking at me, I'm the type of person that would stick out like that, but it just happens for some reason. And that's a supernatural gift that the Lord has given to me that I can thus give to others. So I've always thought in terms of pastoral leadership, it's kind of silly when churches just pull something out of a hat and then say, I want to do that as our mission. You have to think collectively as a group, as individuals, what are the gifts that God has given to me and how can I give those gifts to others? Is everybody tracking with me on that? So that's good leadership. Bad leadership is just coming up with a generic program that could fit every single church in the world. I think I want to drill down and ask, And I think as your pastor over the year and a half, I think I've learned what are the specific gifts that the individuals of this congregation are good at giving. So I picked music out because we have a lot of people that are music, and we have that history in the past. So I would say that maybe somebody has the gift of, like, watching children. So when Sarah and I go teach the people, their gift to those people is watching the mom's kids. So, yeah. But that's a good question. Yeah, I always try to ask through prayer and reflection the Lord. Okay, so I have hobby horses. Everybody has hobby horses. I don't want to get on my hobby horse and start. Yeah, so I try my best. We're all biased, though. I admit that. Yeah, one of the flagship churches of the EPC, First Presbyterian Orlando. I'm going to assume they have some doctors in their congregation, but they started a whole medical wing outreach idea, if I remember correctly. So, but I'm going to assume that they have doctors or nurses in their congregation that can make this happen. I don't think they just pulled it out of a hat and said, we're going to do a medical mission. And I think that they had to have some retired doctors or something like that make it work. So, okay, so local missions and secularized missions. So there's actually some interesting missions that started in the church locally that we probably all know. Goodwill, for example, was started, or I didn't know specifically what denomination. I knew they had a Christian tie, and I guess they still do, but they were started by Methodists, so that's kind of interesting. It's interesting that the proto-hospital started in Calvin's Geneva, so I think that's St. Vincent there. I did the slide a while ago, but so the first hospitals were started by the deacons in Calvin's Geneva, which is pretty cool. Our tradition could kind of claim the proto-hospital. I didn't know this until I went to seminary, but a lot of the great universities in the United States were founded originally to train ministers. So Harvard, Princeton, Yale, all the Ivy League schools originally were seminaries that started to train clergy. Probably always need new institutions founded to kind of keep them honest, but I didn't know that until I went to seminary and kind of could see how local missions started. But we kind of have a problem, I think, in America because we're kind of anti-tradition, I think, and I would say I have a disposition that way, but we're very low church. That's kind of rooted in our bones. So you look back at the local missions that are founded in the United States, and they're not typically under the rule and reign of the church, so to speak. They're started by somebody, and I actually kind of think that's a little bit of, I'm going to try to opt for a middle approach. I don't want the EPC to take over missions, and I don't want people to just be by, I want mutual accountability and partnership, because I think when missions thrive, both of them are there. Does that make sense? So I want to go for a medium approach. But I think America is typically defined by a very low church mentality. Even if you look at the great revivals in the United States, the second and first Great Awakening, they're very low church type of approach to how to do church ministry. You don't see that in England, for example, or in the continent of Europe. Actually, you kind of see it in the global South. There's kind of a American version of that, which is actually quite interesting because missionaries from the United States probably went and started that. I kind of have a game with Sarah. It's always weird social things that pop up in Mexico that I heard similar growing up in the United States. And I'm like, I wonder what missionary took that to Mexico, because there is no way that they had thought about that organically. Some missionary had to have gone to Mexico and taught them that type of thinking. So there is a good sense that the free market mentality, which Americans are known for, and we solve a lot of problems, is great in parachurch organization. It means people can innovate, they can fit specific needs. So, for example, at the General Assembly, we heard of a testimony from a woman who's actually an ordained teaching elder who reaches out to strippers. It was a very interesting ministry. I would never do that, obviously, because I'm a male. If I said, oh, I feel called to do this, I think... Yeah. Sesha would be like, what are you doing? You're a little bit of a weirdo, but that's true. Sorry, I was just thinking in the church context there. I actually felt bad for her because Jeff Jeremiah told her she had 3 minutes to pray and give a blurb for her thing, and then she just got like really into it and started talking, and she hit that 3-minute mark, and Jeff Jeremiah is a really serious guy. He just tapped on her shoulder and said, it's time to pray. So she's forever in my mind of Jeff Jeremiah making her cry at the General Assembly, which I felt kind of bad for her, but I'm a rule keeper, so I was like, if follow the rules, but she's etched in my mind for that moment in the General Assembly this past year. But that's a specific gift that she has to reach out to those type of people. And it's a kind of a parachurch that she started. But she's in connection through the EPC. Her local church has jurisdiction over, keeps her accountable. She was actually ordained to office through the EPC. I think it's Presbytery of the East. So it's a little bit weird, but that was just one story. Yeah, Mexico, when Sarah got her green card to come back to the United States, thankfully she's a woman because the men, they actually have to strip naked and an ICE officer actually has to inspect them for tattoos, actually. So her cousin had to get that done to him. So yeah, the tattoos, that's an interesting, and then Chicago too. But so the bad, I think the low church tradition downplays the importance of the church. In reality, in outreach ministry replaces the church in the worst case, but the long-term approach should always be to get people into the pews. Parachurch is not the local church. So, and I'm thinking in terms of parachurch. Since we are Protestant, every outreach thing or the city mission or crew or CCO, they're all parachurches. So we don't have jurisdiction in the EPC over them. So. Yeah, so high church would be, I think, in terms of like Roman Catholicism or Anglicanism, typically.
So hierarchical?
Yeah, so they, as far as I know, I guess I'm far removed from Roman Catholicism, but it's my understanding that the church in a perfect world would have jurisdiction over all those type of ministries, if that makes sense. Yeah, so in the world of Presbyterianism, there are different denominations that have more of a high church approach to doing ministry and outreach. So the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, they're pretty, if they want to support a missionary, it's done through the denomination. This person doesn't have to raise any support. So there's kind of pros and cons to that. Or in the PCA, they don't, I mean, I guess people would work with like CCO or crew or other outfits, but they actually have their own thing called Reformed University Fellowship. That's done through the PCA, if I'm correct. So that would be more of a high church. I'm an institutionalist myself, so I'm probably showing where I believe in institutions, and you need strong institutions to run a country. Yeah, so I guess I'm swinging back and showing my... But I think a lot of good sociological data points that as the nation goes, so goes the institutions are going well, if that makes sense. Okay, so I guess this is defining my middle medium view, or via media, you can call it that, can be reached. So this is the ideal one. So not one, not the other. It's quite interesting hearing a solo sing while I'm trying to lecture or teach. But the local church supports missions that reach out to people that the church doesn't have the time to invest in. And I'm not saying that as a demeaning thing, but we can only reach so many people in the local church, but the parachurch is... The beauty of it is if it's done well, they're reaching out to people that we just can't start a gazillion ministries to reach this niche. We support them financially, but they go out and do the work that we cannot do. And I went to seminary with tons of people that are not called to be local pastors, but are called to the parachurch, and they do this well. But ministry partners and the local church should always be pushing people towards membership in the local church. So in a perfect world, the parachurch was created to support the local church, if that makes sense, not the other way around. Okay, so parachurch. And I'm defining parachurch as ministries that are born separate of the local church, if that makes sense. Okay, so local missions are more or less all parachurch, unless they're under ecclesial authority of the church. So... One example of ecclesial authority is the PCA has their Reformed University Fellowship. And sometimes I've actually gotten a few emails about them, and that's their big shtick, that they point out that they are tied more to the local church in the PCA context, and they'll ask for money. It's just an interesting, different dynamic that they have. But perhaps mutual relationship can be struck. Parachurches keep churches accountable for their lack of evangelism, for example. So I know, that's kind of the whole point of, university type of outreach. They do evangelism really well. Sometimes they can keep us in check and point out that we're not doing a very good job, for example. But churches also need to keep parachurches in check with their tendency to define what they are doing as the church. I saw this happen once in my internship where Young Life, I know some of us have had experience with Young Life. Is anybody? Okay, so Young Life is a really good parachurch, but it also depends kind of on the chapter of the Young Life. And this specific chapter wanted our church to abolish its youth program and said, we'll just take over it, because they basically said, like, we're the church for young people. And our pastor said, no, we're pulling our funding because you fundamentally don't understand what the local church is and what the difference between the local church and Young Life is to be. I said that one time we had an internship seminar class at Trinity School for Ministry, and somebody was like, well, Young Life's not all like that. I was like, no, that's not what I'm saying. It was just this specific chapter was trying to say that. So they had to get rid of Young Life. The goal was always to get kids into the local church, get them tied with elders, deacons, their pastor, and other older folks to disciple them. So it's not like one or the other. It's both and approach to ministry. But when both work together, mutual bonds and friendships can happen, and success can be reached. So now I'm going to give a bad experience and a good experience of how I worked through this. One of the nice things about, because Mount Lebanon EPC is a wealthier congregation, and we're in a younger demographic, we always got sent to these charity dinners for free. So it was actually quite nice for those of us that have grown up in Pittsburgh. The Lamont, traditionally, it's not as good as it used to be, but it's historically been defined as the place to go out for a really nice dinner. It sits up on Mount Washington. You can see it. It's quite lovely, although I took Sarah there for an anniversary dinner, and it was just not that good. But anyways, these parachurches set up these like annual banquets, and nobody ever wanted to go to them, so they always gave the tickets to us. So we got to eat at the Lamont one time and then Heinz Field at the other time. So this time when we went to the Human Coalition, we were invited to this banquet dinner because nobody else wanted to go. So we went for a free meal at the Lamont because, hey, what else am I doing on a Friday night? And I get to go to this. So we went to this outfit called the Human Coalition, and I'm going to pick on the Human Coalition today because I think they kind of lost their vision and abstracted the ministry. So we went to this banquet. I'm sorry, this one was actually at Heinz Field. So it was a pregnancy crisis center that tried to persuade young women who had an unplanned pregnancy to choose life. I still don't like that phrase, choose life. Seems a little bit odd to me. I mean, I know what they're saying, but I haven't come up with something different. But the ministry banquet, when we were sitting there, we were like, well, this will be great. We'll get a nice dinner. We'll get to hear all these lovely testimonies about women choosing life and how the church came to set in. But he was the CEO of this outfit, which kind of like became a lobbying campaign to the Republican Party, shifted in the middle from like hearing all these wonderful testimonies to then it was a huge like political rally. It was just very, very strange. So it went to a political rally. And actually what was weird about the whole thing was the emotion in the room shifted from, it was kind of, people were interested in the stories, but as soon as they shifted over to this political idea, like there was this fervency that swept in the room that was very, very, it made us uncomfortable because we thought we were just going to get dinner to hear about how local people in the church had partnered with them and were doing great work. So Brian Fisher is his name, of the newly branded Human Coalition. I guess he did a pretty good job because I can still remember all the fancy graphics and everything that they had. They went around and bought up all these grassroots organizations, which were already doing fantastic work, and turned it into this national brand. And they moved their call center from Pittsburgh all the way to Dallas, which was a little bit odd. But the whole experience just made us quite uncomfortable. So the results, they totally changed their parachurch and essentially created a lobbying movement. And he lives in D.C., I think, or he either splits time between D.C. and Dallas. I spent some time in Dallas, so as soon as he stepped on stage, I knew, oh, this guy is familiar. I've seen a lot of people like this in Dallas in the past. So the results were that our home church pulled funding from the Crisis Pregnancy Center because one of our elders, Bruce Tenenbaum, who actually was involved in my ordination, he's a wonderful guy. He was our moderator a year ago. Sat down with Brian Fisher, and Brian Fisher's like, I want to come to church and preach and do all this campaigning thing for my thing. And he's like, no, we're here to preach the gospel. And I want to unleash people in our congregation who are really interested in helping, we had people that did this, but he just couldn't get through to Brian Fisher. So they pulled their funding and put it somewhere else that was more of a grassroots type of doing ministry. So that was the bad experience. So I don't know if anybody's had an experience like that, but it was interesting. Okay, good experience. There's another ministry in Pittsburgh called Prism. I think it's been around for quite a long time. Jim, has it been around since
my parents have been.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so Prism has really impressed me when we were in Pittsburgh in our home church. Again, we got invited to a dinner because nobody else wanted to go. And if I'm correct, the original founder actually is a member of Beverly Heights Presbyterian. It's weird how Presbyterian world is so small, but I'm pretty sure he's a member of Nate's church who we've met before. But Prism was created to specifically minister to international students, and they really impressed Sarah and I. Not only, we're also like to do international ministry, so it's quite a fun banquet to go to, but they specifically do outreach to people in the Oakland neighborhood. So if you're familiar with Pittsburgh, Oakland's kind of the hub for all the universities. So you have Pitt there, Carlo, where my sister went, Carnegie Mellon. It's kind of like the big STEM school. Am I missing another one? Duquesne's a little bit close. Point Park, yes. Yeah, there's a lot of schools close to that area. So Prism ministers to them, and they actually excel at it. But they intentionally push new Christians into ethnic churches. One couple we sat next to, they paired when you sat next to a couple or student, and you can kind of chat with them about their experience, which was quite smart. But he went to the Chinese evangelical church, for example. But they were always pushing people into the local church. It's interesting that social context defines everything, because Prism seemed to me to be kind of, quote, reformed in flavor. Your dad's parents went to a Presbyterian church,
yeah.
Right? Yeah, so since they were more reformed in flavor, I think that was, they had a high view of the church, so they were pushing people towards doing work in the church. So one of our churches in our presbytery, Belfield EPC, which is a fantastic church, has a lot, you'd be surprised how many pastors in our presbytery came from that church. I think Rich Herbster is one pastor I know, another pastor I know, his name's Henry, but it's got a really great long history in our presbytery, and the pastor there is awesome. His name's Josh, wonderful guy, current moderator of the Presbytery of the Alleghenies. But their church is interesting because they're about 200, 250 members during the summer, but when they snap into time for school, they go up to about 450 to 500 because all these students are filtered in from Prism into Belfield. So it's a pretty cool congregation, if you ask me. It's also an interesting dynamic because they have a lot of doctors and lawyers and professors that kind of support the ministry so that these college students can come in, because college students really can't tithe. So it's interesting how their model works out. So we heard tons of excellent testimonies throughout the banquet of those who came to faith. There was a gentleman from Pakistan, I think, that had come to faith. Japan, which I've said before, Japan's kind of a dark place to hear the God. Not too many missionaries are successful in Japan. I mean, going way back to the 16th century. So had somebody from Japan come to faith, and might have been the first Japanese Christian I've ever actually met in my whole life. But it was really a cool banquet and to get involved in. But they encouraged reciprocal gift giving. So when they had the time to write your check, the come to Jesus moment, I suppose, it wasn't just write your check, it was fill out your information card, we'll get in touch with you, we want you to pair you with a student and get involved and everything like that. So I thought that they did a really great job. It was really concrete, it was local, where the other example was really abstract and kind of weird, I think. So Prism is the good example. Okay, so there's other places that we can step in as the local church, and a lot of economists, from what I read, kind of see cracks in the welfare state long term. So perhaps going forward in the future, there might be more of an opportunity for the church to step up and help people. I mean, we currently can, but maybe it'll be even the social welfare net could just kind of fall out, or for example. So perhaps Christians could help and assist the poor more and more. And I have the Didache up there because there's a lot about helping the poor in the Didache. That's a document that normally New Testament's kind of closed at 95. Some people date the Didache at, Didache just means teaching, at 120. But interestingly enough, I have a friend who thinks that it's dated in like the 40s. He actually thinks, this is kind of a new revolutionary type thing, but he thinks that it's kind of the early window into how the early church was practicing their faith. I mean, it still is if it's dated in 120, but if it's dated before Paul's writing his letters, it's even more early, which is interesting. But I think that it's a little bit hard for us sometimes to compete with state or not, NGO. I think NGOs is the tech. I never knew what that meant until recently. We simply don't have the money to compete with them. They can put us under. They can do things more abstractly and mobilize people. So it's sometimes hard, unfortunately. You know, I read about Calvin's Geneva, and it's really inspiring. Like, they started hospitals, and their deacons are going around every Sunday and giving alms to people. And I'm like, this is really cool. But you can kind of see it as the precursor to the way our government is run right now. So they kind of stole our vision, so to speak, and now it's secularized. But it's just hard to compete with the government, I think. So Calvin's just weird. I mean, just because I've spent time with him, most historical figures are weird. Though, I think you can pick one side out of him you like. And then, but yeah, that's true. There is part times in his career where he's transforming. Other times he's not, so... But even the early Christians were stretched with money. So the Didache exhorts Christians to help the poor. It's actually really focused on behavior. It could probably make us a little bit uncomfortable sometimes. It comes across as, if you actually read it, you can pull it up. It's public domain. It comes across as extremely legalistic. It's like, do this, do this, do this. There's not much grace in the Didache, which is probably why it didn't make it into our New Testament. So it's helpful, but at the same time, it's not Holy Scripture. But what's interesting about the Didache is we can tell that they were stretched because you know a false teacher by if they stay over three nights. So if you host somebody to help the church, if they're going to stay more than three nights, according to the Didache, they are a false teacher. So I thought that was quite funny. Okay, so getting to our kind of local missionary context, how do we create social bonds with our local missionaries? And we're kind of already doing this, so I'm just picking three that we've helped in my duration as your pastor. So we have Crew, Hope for Renewal, Gary Kirst, probably the coolest example because he's an EPC teaching elder and Dean and I see him once a month. He was discipled by Jim. I mean, it's pretty crazy how we have ties to him. And longer term, we can help him as they really get their feet off the ground with programming. And then the CCR, which I know we've had plenty of experience with as well. But those are just kind of the three that I picked currently. So Gary Kirst coming to preach, then we gave him his support for the year, but we just didn't stop with that. The missions committee took him out for lunch and had a time of gift giving and bonding and reciprocity there. So that was pretty cool. And I get to kind of keep tabs once a month with what Gary Kirst is doing. He's just a really wonderful guy. I mean, I really love Gary. He's got a really great heart. When he says he does something, he actually does it. I can't say that about all pastors, unfortunately, but he's the real deal. So I'm really impressed with Gary. So RPC has done this in the past, so this is kind of the framework. But I'm going to try to argue in our specific local context, less is more. So there's plenty of great ministries out there, and people are, especially as we grow as a church, people are going to come knocking on our door for checks all the time because there's a gazillion great places to give. But what I always want to remind us as your pastor is we're not called to save the world or even in some ways make the world a better place. That's the Lord's job. We're pretty small players in his divine story. So pick one or two or three, partner with them and do them well. Excellency, I think, is what we should push towards instead of mediocrity and just going and partner with a gazillion different ones. And then it could stretch you and just make you burn out, for example. So realizing that we're not the world and called to save the world or make the world a better place, kind of poking fun at the tech sector because that's the phrase that they use, make the world a better place. I hear that a lot with people that work in tech. I'm like, no, you're making the world a better place according to what you want to do, not according to what the whole world wants. So you're not listening to people. It's according to you. So try to get involved with local missions. I'm endorsing that. if they are through the church, for example, or parachurch organizations, if you give them money as individuals, try to get involved. Just don't cut the check if you can. Try to get involved with them. And we don't have to have just one group that we get behind, like Jim was saying. It can be somebody really likes to work with CCO and does that really well, or somebody, I don't know, if Prism existed here in Erie, somebody gets involved with that. It doesn't have to be just one size fits all for everybody. I'm pretty open to having different ones. So one, two, or three, for example. Okay, so all important thing is grassroots ministry. So we should always ask the question, will this work from a grassroots perspective? So bottom-up approach instead of top-down. Showing my American Americanism there. So we should think about local mission, the concrete concepts and not abstract terms. I think this is personally why Prism excelled and Human Coalition did not. And a lot of churches in the POA were actually pulling money from Human Coalition because of that. The EPC is really into kind of the grassroots type of ministry and partnerships. That's where the denomination is going. So I'm trying to point that out as your pastor. So it's not just my hobby horse, but it's the hobby horse of our denomination. Don't overextend yourself, for you're not called to save the world. That's the Lord's job. I'll finish up with current trends in the EPC. So many of my teaching elder friends are rethinking how local mission work is done. They may not argue through the lens of gift giving and reciprocity like I do, but we end up with the same conclusions. So my mentor, Nate Devlin, and I, when we get lunch and check in once a year like we did, we actually talked a little bit about local missions and kind of the future of the church and things like that. And we were actually coming to the same conclusions, but we just had different theologies, I guess, of how that got done. So I told him to read John Barclay and he bought the book. So I persuaded him at least to do that. I don't know if he actually read it or not, but we're coming to the same conclusions. Actually, he asked me that during my ordination exam. One thing I learned in business was we had always used the phrase running lean. Organizations they get too big. They just do a gazillion things okay, and they don't strive for excellence. So our CEO would always use the phrase running lean, running lean, running lean. So I thought, well, you could actually take that and apply that to the local church. Less is more, and running lean means that you can push for excellence instead of just doing everything okay. A lot of churches just kind of they're waiting in the world of mediocrity instead of excelling at doing something. So I want to push us to excel. I also see a push to run the church lean. So social bonding through reciprocity and mutual exchange of gifts is the way to go. And finally, I don't know about you, but I personally get fired up when thinking about the friendships, partnerships, and many other possibilities that could happen if we frame ministry in the gift-giving context. If it's abstract, I can't really get interested in doing it. If it's more concrete, I can really get behind it. So that's my shtick for local church. Next week we'll do international, and it's just a coincidence. No, it's not. That it's right before we go on a mission or have kind of our proto mission trip as a church. So next week I'll be on my soapbox and why I specifically worked with the mission committee to kind of go about trying to do this on the international level too. So we first have to have an understanding of mission through gift giving, local context, and then international context too. So. Yeah, and then they come from countries that are they have more in common with the Christian worldview, so to speak. Like, family is a big deal to other countries. I've been thinking a lot recently about how America kind of talks about being family-centered, but I actually don't kind of think that it is. I think it's kind of abstract. But when people come from different countries, they have such a high view of the family, maybe too much. It can become an idol, but... Yeah, they would be more in line with a local church context where you can have adopted parents, grandparents, brothers and sisters, things like that. So, yeah. No, but that is true. When I was working through it, I thought Prism does this really well, but then you look around at Erie, and unless I'm just missing or striking out, there's not really any type of ministry like that in Erie. So, yeah, and I know Prism would do Bible study. So a lot of the students were men who are grad students because they have such a great, at Carnegie Mellon is a great school in Pitt. And they would take the women. Somebody would watch their kiddos and give them time off. Because you have to remember, they don't have the social connections at all. So they're very much open to the church and the ministry. And they would watch their kids while they would do this Bible study for an hour or two. So it was pretty cool. That's actually how the Japanese woman came to faith. They had just started having kids. Husband's in grad school, which means he's got to work a lot. And she connected with Prism. So, yeah, that's something that could be replicated, albeit on a smaller stage. They're a huge outfit, but yeah, it could be replicated here in Erie. Yeah, so it's interesting, like the tech, like thinking about the miracle and the preaching of the gospel. They're in scripture. They're merged closer together. It's in our modern context. We want to break them apart, where it seems like the early church kind of realized that you feed the poor and you preach to them too. It's not one or the other. So like feeding them without praying with them would be looked at the apostles as just strange. So hopefully I conveyed that last week. Yeah, one thing I've noticed, it's interesting working with international people, is sometimes they kind of intuitively pick up on that our society was built by religious people. So if they come to love the United States, they get actually quite interesting in the history, and they go back and they read and they're like, well, there's something onto this about these church people that came here and built this society. I mean, yeah, it did evolve and change over time, but they're more in tune with that, I think, than maybe we are sometimes. I heard a really weird story on NPR. This wasn't in America, but it was a gentleman that was leaving. ISIS kicked out people in his area, so he wanted to get to England. And he says, I'm going to get to England, I'm going to get a job, and I'm going to join a church. But his whole thing was he was like craving to get to England to get involved in the church life. And I thought, oh, that's a weird statement. But then I was like, maybe he's thinking, oh, this society is more safe and secure and I want to live there because they kind of borrowed from that tradition and made that type of society, if that makes sense. It's just something I've thought a lot about because America is a very Protestant country. So anyways, okay, well, I'll close there. Thank you, guys. Sorry for my shtick about the Protestant nation, but I think about that a lot, actually.